It gives me great pleasure today to welcome Richard Betts for our seminar. And he's Head of Climate Impacts at the Met Office Hadley Centre and Chair of Climate Impacts at the University of Exeter. And he did his PhD in Physics at Bristol and an MSc in Meteorology and Climatology at Birmingham. And he's been working on aspects of climate change, in particular work in the Amazon for a long time. And we've been to-ing and fro-ing on the Amazon dieback for as long as I can remember in various bars around the world. He's also had a major role in the IPCC. He was a lead author on the fourth assessment report of the IPCC in Working Group 1, and had a quite important role in the fifth assessment report, Working Group 2, on impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability, and also a major role in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. So, as well as doing leading a lot of cutting edge research on the Amazon dieback, he's been involved in shaping a lot of the climate change and impacts agenda through the IPCC. Okay, so welcome, Richard. I'll just hit the lights for you.
Thanks very much, Yavinda, for the kind invitation to speak here. It's a great pleasure. As you say, we've been sort of talking about this kind of issue for probably nearly two decades now. What I thought I would do is start with a very famous, or maybe I should say notorious, climate model result, which came out of the Met Office Hadley Centre models in the 1990s, which had an enormous impact about basically the model suggesting that the Amazon forests would completely die away as a result of global climate change. And I'll talk about what we've learned about that simulation, what the more recent models do, which is different, and then try and conclude where we think the threats may be. So is it really a genuine threat? Were we just crying wolf to put this out, this scary scenario? So to start with, this is the famous result from a paper led by Peter Cox, who was at the Met Office at the time. He's now at the University of Exeter. Myself, Chris Jones and others published in Nature in the year 2000, which had an enormous impact in the media when it came out. Basically, it was the first attempt to...
I'm sorry, can I just quickly... Are we going to get a copy of the slides afterwards?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll leave them on here and then actually be distributed.
If you have a website, we always have them.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So this paper, it was published in Nature as it was the first go at turning an atmosphere-ocean climate model into a global carbon cycle model. So the atmosphere-ocean model, already a big, hefty piece of code, basically the same computer model that does the weather forecast. It's used here in Oxford climateprediction.net. Some of you here may be in the group that uses that. Yeah. So in fact you still use that version, have CM3 in fact. So it was already a substantial climate model in itself, but it was just a physical part of the climate system at that time. What we did was to include the global carbon cycle, so a global model of vegetation called TRIFID, and then a global ocean carbon cycle model as well, and interacting with the atmospheric CO2. So instead of running our future climate simulations by imposing a scenario of concentrations of CO2, we actually impose a scenario of emissions and let the climate model work out its own atmospheric CO2, taking account of how the biosphere in the ocean absorbed and emitted CO2. As part of that, the terrestrial biosphere model actually allowed for vegetation to grow and die back in individual grid squares, as you can see here. A very simplistic model of the land biosphere, of course. Instead of thousands of different species, we have millions of species that we have in reality. We just boiled down the vegetation into five plant functional types, broadleaf and needleleaf tree, C3 and C4 grass and shrub. We ignored anything else. So that was basically our sort of first go at global biosphere model within a carbon cycle model. And what happened was, when we ran the model forward in time, we got not only warming of the world, of course, and the usual changes in rainfall patterns that you see in all climate models, we got a very severe warming and a very severe drying in the Amazon region, which meant that the forest, which was simulated well at the present day, was not supported by the end of the 21st century. This sort of a huge sort of area showing white on there. This is the fractional of cover, fraction of land covered by forest, the broadleaf tree functional type. It became effectively savanna or even desert in some areas. So this enormous, shocking result, which it's only a computer model result, yet it kind of reminded people that possibly in these models, which are supposed to represent the real world, there is the potential for major regional changes. But we were quite surprised about the impact that it had. Perhaps we're a little bit naive, I don't know. Here's a cartoon that was in New Scientist.
I'm not sure whether it was celebrating or mocking the results, but basically envisaging the Amazon Desert Tour 2031, pointing out the last remaining tree, everything else just kind of barren, and so on. So I guess when your work's being mocked in New Scientist, you'll know you're making some kind of impact.
But, I mean, joking aside, it actually seemed to have an impact on policy as well. It was covered in the world media by a huge amount. This is a story in The Independent where, as well as the Amazon dieback projection, it was the feedbacks on the climate change from the global carbon cycle, including the global soils, accelerated global warming in the projection as well. So one of the headlines was faster global warming, but it specifically said that it highlighted the simulation of dieback of the Amazon rainforest in that area. And this was shortly before one of the COP meetings. We just had COP22 in Marrakesh, coming on from the Paris meeting last year, where the world finally agreed to unify, to take action to keep climate change below 2 degrees or even 1.5 degrees. Before then, the only time that actually had an agreement was in 1997 in Kyoto, where the developing countries signed up to start to take some kind of action. Whether it really had an effect or not is debatable. But shortly after that, there was a meeting in The Hague, which actually they failed to reach an agreement at that COP meeting in December 2000. And one of the reasons it failed was that people couldn't agree on the carbon sink issue. And this is from the proceedings of that meeting. One particular delegate specifically mentioned our results, the Hadley Centre results, suggesting that the terrestrial biosphere may shift from being a sink to a source. There was a lot of concern about, they were talking about using land use change in forestry as carbon sinks, and should they different aspects of that be included in the agreement. And Tuvalu cautioned against it because of the potential for sink to source transition. I wouldn't say that this is the only factor, but it was one of a sort of many lines of research which were causing concern at that time. So in actual fact, as I say, that meeting failed, but they had another meeting 6 months later where they did actually come to an agreement. But the agreement allowed for land use and land use change and forestry activities to include afforestation and reforestation as part of the clean development mechanism. But they specifically avoided deforestation because of concerns about the permanence of forests which are protected. Basically, if countries are paid to protect their forests against climate as a carbon sink, and then it dies because of climate change, then you've lost out there. That was the kind of simplistic view there. So and we did actually get some criticism for perhaps going public too early with this, with our results, which was seen as leading into this kind of policy decision. Of course, as probably people here will know, more recently in Copenhagen 2009, finally the avoided deforestation did actually come back in the Red Plus policy. So you can now get benefit from saving forests. You don't have to merely afforest or reforest and so on. So, but there was a delay of many years before that became part of the policy. So it was kind of a wake-up call that this kind of climate modelling result can have a big impact on policy. So we really ought to make sure that we know why it's happening and whether we can be confident in it or not. And indeed, the new climate models, which came out in the last 5 years or so, the new one from the Hadley Centre in particular, does not show this catastrophic dieback of the Amazon forest. So the top panel there is the same model simulations I showed in my first slide, just expressed slightly differently, but it's the forest fraction at the end of the century. Well, actually, no, in this one is expressed in terms of at reaching the target of four times pre-industrial CO2. So a slightly more hypothetical simulation, but the same principle really.
And then the bottom one is from the new model, the latest one, which is currently in operation for climate projections, which is done for the last IPCC report. It will be soon be superseded by a new model, but this is the most recent one, which is operational. It's had Gen 2 ES, stands for Earth System. So again, that is a carbon cycle model based on an atmospheric ocean GCM climate model, and with the interactive vegetation. And again, you see here the Amazon forest, by the four times the CO2 state, is still looking quite widespread, quite healthy, and not showing any signs of the catastrophic dieback from the older HADCN3 based model. So it's something very different going on there. And to put that into the context of other models, this is from the CMIP3 generation of models. So CMIP stands for Coupled Model Into Comparison Project, so an international program comparing these Earth system models. This was the third such program, which was done in the mid-2000s. So HADCN3 models included in that, and also HADGEM 1, an earlier version of HADGEM 2, which I just showed, but very close to it. So between those two generations of model, the whole atmospheric dynamics code was completely rewritten, so it's a very different model. And this shows the South American carbon store, so much of which is, of course, the Amazon, projected over the 21st century. It's paid by Chris Hunterford at CEH. I think you've been your cohort on this, and I as well. It shows all the different climate models listed at the right there. And there's this sort of the fan of different projected changes in carbon store, most of them showing an increase in carbon store in South America. This is the HADCN3 based one here, showing this transition to a large loss of forest and becoming a large source of carbon by the end of the century. HADGEM 1 is the fourth from the bottom, so it kind of turns over earlier than some others. So it's quite a large range of uncertainty, but HADCN3 is the most drastic. The black lines are inventory measurements of estimates of carbon, forest carbon, from studies like the rainfall network and so on. So you can see that all the models are underestimating the uptake of carbon, but they're still showing a general uptake to start with. And then some of them flatten out and some decline by the end of the century, but quite a range of results. So one question is, the obvious question is, why do we get these very different results? Why are the regional climate changes so different, for example? One possibility, which is initially thought of, is it simply that there are biases in the present day of these models? So this expresses this in terms of using the Köppen climate classifications for clarity, showing that the classifications across South America in the top left are based on observational climatology. So the dark reds are basically rainforest climates, and then the pinks are more kind of savanna type climates. HADCN3 is in the middle of the top row, so you can see that the red area is much smaller. So the model is too dry at the present day, but it still has some rainforest type climate in the east. Some have a similar kind of limited rainforest area in terms of with this classification, some have even less. HADGEM 1, almost at the top left, has a fairly realistic extent of rainforest climate, not as realistic as it could be, but better than HADCN3. But some models have a worse bias in the climate of the present day than HADCN3, which is suggesting that since they are not giving this large drying and dieback that HADCN3 does, perhaps this is not the answer to that question. And you can see that again here. This is from a paper from Yavinda from a few years ago, which looked at all these different models from that CMIP3 model into comparison study. And this is looking at the climate change in the eastern Amazon, expressed in terms of a kind of climate space diagram with quantities which are relevant to whether rainforests can be supported or not. Obviously quite an approximate representation, but it's quite neat for showing the general principle here. So the idea being that less than 1,500 millimetres of annual rainfall does not support rainforest, and then this cumulative water deficit here of a deficit of greater than 300 millimetres, that space up there is basically too dry, too little rainfall, too much evaporation to support rainforest. And the points at the end of the arrows, each end of the arrow here, are the present day state and then the end of the 21st century state from all these different climate models listed at the right hand side there. The grey figures at the back are where each individual location across the Amazon looks like at the present day in terms of these climate spaces. So you can see that most of the models are showing a general kind of drying trend moving into this area, but actually a lot of them are already in that space at the present day in terms of the raw climate model output. So the climate models are showing this bias at the present day. So you try and get around that by essentially correcting for the systematic bias at the present day, and then looking at what that would suggest in terms of the bias corrected future climate projections. And you see that most of the models are moving towards this rainforest not supported climate space, but only had CN3 model in the dark green goes deeply into that zone. Had GEM1 in the orange line goes towards it but doesn't quite reach it. So many of the models are showing a sort of drying climate, perhaps moving towards a dry tropical forest type climate rather than natural rainforest climate, but not going into this kind of catastrophic rainforest loss type climate. And that seems to be independent of whether they have the bias at the present day or not. So given that the models do different things in terms of regional climates, something must be driving this. What is it? It turns out that it's quite strongly linked to patterns of sea surface temperature change in both the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. Northeast Brazil, as it happens, is one area where there's a very good skill in predicting seasonal rainfall. That's one of the hardest challenges in climate modelling at the moment, is to make predictions on seasonal timescales. But there's a few areas in the world where it is quite predictable because of a strong teleconnection to sea surface temperatures. So northeast Brazil has this very strong teleconnection to the equatorial Atlantic and the eastern Amazon to some extent as well. The western Amazon seems to be influenced by the equatorial Pacific sea surface temperatures. So this study here by Phil Harris, also at CEH, he basically drove the climate model in terms of his atmosphere-only version of the atmosphere and the vegetation, but instead of having the models work out its own ocean temperatures, he prescribed patterns of ocean temperatures from previous simulations and broke it down into changing the pattern just in terms of elevating the global mean temperature, and then looking at taking away the global mean warming and just looking at the pattern of change, and then further breaking it down into the pattern of change in the Atlantic only and in the Pacific only, and the different lines give different results for that kind of factorial approach. So this is the mean over the Amazon with those different drivers of change. So the solid line is the control of the present day state. The dotted line, so here, is the change when you get all these factors happening all together. And then the other ones are the different factors of the global mean warming, the local SST anomalies and so on. So if you look at, say, the temperature, then the global mean warming has quite has some effect on the local temperature warming in the top right, but then the patterns of sea surface temperature change kind of add on to that fairly linearly. But then when it comes to the rainfall and the soil moisture on the left-hand side, the global mean warming doesn't make a huge amount of difference to the local rainfall. It's actually the patterns of sea surface temperature that affect it. And the Atlantic affects part of the year, the end of the year, and then the Pacific has a stronger effect in the earlier part of the year. So both areas of the ocean are affecting the rainfall in the Amazon at different times. But then if you look at the vegetation, the NPP, the net plant productivity, that is affected by the temperature directly, not just the rainfall. So there the more linear effect of the warming comes in as well. So basically the in terms of the effect on the vegetation, the higher temperatures have an effect, and the patterns of rainfall, which are affected by different patterns of sea surface temperature change, are all kind of conspiring to reduce the vegetation growth in this model. So then if we then look at other climate models, first of all, I focus on the CMIP3 models. So this models from different climate centres from around the world, looking at the left-hand bottom left figure here. So the blue cross is in that. This is showing the change in precipitation in the southern Amazon in June, July, August, and how that relates to the pattern or the gradient of sea surface temperature across the tropical Atlantic. So it seems that when you look at the different models in the CMIP3 ensemble in the blue crosses, and then also different variants of the HADCM3 model, you can run, like in climateprediction.net, you can run the same model but with different parameter settings, basically, to give you sort of slightly different variants of the same model. Looking at those all together, there is some sort of relationship between the strength of this temperature gradient in the tropical Atlantic and the strength of the rainfall reduction in the southern Amazon. And then if you look at where the HADCM3, the older HADCM3 model and the new HADCM2 model come on that kind of gradient, it's a similar figure but with extended axes, basically. It goes out to two rather than one on both axes. You can see that the HADCM3LC model showed a very large increase, large tropical Atlantic temperature gradient and a large decrease in precipitation, whereas the HADCM2 model is at the other end with the other side of change of the Atlantic temperature gradient and an increase in rainfall. So this all kind of ties in with the Atlantic temperature gradient playing an important role in the regional precipitation signal in the Amazon. And you can see the two different patterns of change and the two different versions of the head of the model at the top there. You can see opposite signs of change there.
So it largely comes down to what happens in the temperatures in the ocean, in particular in the tropical Atlantic. But it's not just that, because that's what's causing the regional climate change in itself. But then there's also feedbacks from the forest back to the climate, which have further effects. So these maps are showing the changes in precipitation projected by the HADCM3 model by the 2020s, 2050s and 2080s relative to pre-industrial state. Blue showing an increase, orange and red showing a decrease. So you can see the large decrease of Amazon rainfall there. So that's the change that we get without any feedbacks on the carbon cycle. It's just in this particular study, I'm going to present a set of different experiments which try and break out different kinds of feedbacks on the climate. The feedbacks both from the carbon cycle and feedbacks from the land surface as well. And this is the land surface feedbacks to start with. So the change in precipitation is shown there, and then that drives these changes in global vegetation. This is three of the plant functional types here, so the two different tree types at the top and in the middle, and then changing shrub cover at the bottom. So apologies for the rainbow colour scale, by the way. It is quite old. We wouldn't do that these days, and this is really undesirable now. So the greens and blues are showing the increasing vegetation cover. So the boreal forest regions are showing an increase in forest cover. The tundra regions are showing an increase in shrub cover. And then the yellows, oranges, reds and blacks are showing a decrease in vegetation, which is mainly seen in the Amazon in the broadleaf tree. So we're seeing these patterns of global vegetation change around the world. But then we did two simulations, one including these vegetation changes feeding back on the climate, and another with vegetation fixed at the present day state. And the difference between the two would show us what the effect of the vegetation feedback on the climate from the change in the land surface properties. So not carbon cycle feedbacks, but changing things like surface albedo, evaporation, and so on. So affecting the surface energy balance, surface moisture balance, recycling of water, the absorption of radiation by the land surface, etc. And that's the impact of that on the precipitation. So it's quite noisy. There's changes in atmospheric circulation across the oceans as well. But you do see a particular interest here in the Amazon region. There's a further reduction in precipitation because of the loss of the forest. So there's much less evaporation, less transpiration, because the forest
it's well known it tends to act to recycle rainfall and keep the rainforest climate moist. And that is seen in the model. So when you start to lose the forest, you lose more rainfall. So there's a positive feedback on the drying happening there.
So that's one of the reasons for the extra warming and drying in the model. Because most at the time, the other models did not have these kind of feedbacks. But then the carbon cycle feedback also has an effect. So the blue line shows the model projection of future CO2 rise, ignoring any of these climate change climate carbon cycle feedbacks, just using a fairly standard IPCC based projection of CO2 concentration. And the red is the model's own projection when you allow for the dieback of the forest and increased respiration from global soils, and also the effect of oceans carbon cycle feedbacks as well to feed back on the global CO2 rise. You get a much more rapid CO2 rise in the model, of which from the land feedback was responsible for most of the acceleration of the CO2 rise, and the Amazon dieback contributed about 20% of that. The rest came from global soils. So it's not all the Amazon, but it was a substantial fraction was from the Amazon. And then that accelerated the temperature rise globally, and even more over land, as shown here. So the land temperatures, instead of rising by about 5 degrees by the end of the century, they rose by almost 8 degrees by the end of the century. So global warming is accelerated by the carbon cycle feedbacks. And then, as you might expect, that emphasises, enhances the patterns of regional climate change as well. So again, this is looking at the difference between simulations with and without feedbacks, this time with the global carbon cycle feedbacks compared to with no carbon cycle feedbacks. It's the difference in precipitation change. And again, you see quite a complex pattern of change because of changes in atmospheric circulation around the world, particularly the tropics and over the oceans. But you see a large further decrease in precipitation over the Amazon region. So the carbon cycle feedback further enhances the regional climate change, the regional climate drying, and also the warming as well. And then that has further effects on the forest cover. So these panels here are showing the further effects in forest dieback in the simulation with carbon cycle feedbacks compared to one without carbon cycle feedbacks. So there was some forest dieback even when you excluded carbon cycle feedbacks, and then when you include the feedbacks, you get even more forest dieback, as shown particularly by the end of the century there. So induces more local feedbacks through the change in evaporation and water recycling and so on. So the whole thing kind of feeds on itself. So that's one of the reasons why you get a more extreme regional climate in the HADCM3 model than without. So given all this and the fact that it depends on different timescales of change and so on, and also given the increased focus these days on not so much projections at certain times in the future, but asking questions like what does like a 2-degree global warming world look like, or a 4-degree world, you can express these regional climate changes at these levels of global warming. And this is using the same climate space method that I showed from Yavinda's paper earlier. So again, it's the CMIP3 models plus the HADCM3 carbon cycle model, HADCM3LC rather. The model, the version of the HADCM3 model that was in CMIP3, the mainstream IPCC projections, did not actually include the interactive vegetation. It was just the atmosphere ocean version. But we had our own version parallel to that, which had the carbon cycle and so on in it. And that's the one that's called HADCM3LC. You can see that at the 1-degree world, most of them are very safely in the upper right portion of this climate space, away from the sort of the danger area for a rainforest. But then as you go to 2 degrees, 3 degrees and 4 degrees, there's quite a spread of results. As you saw in the earlier figures, the further on in time you go, the greater the range of future climate change states which are projected. And some of them do, at 3 degrees, start to reach this the space, climate space, which does not support rainforest. In the diamonds, it's the standard HADCM3 model without the interactive vegetation. The black diamond is the one which does have the vegetation and carbon cycle.
By 4 degrees, the HADCM3 model is going even further into that space, and the HADCM3LC model, with the feedback, is going yet further in. The rest are outside, but perhaps approaching it. So it's just a different way of framing that, but perhaps in a way which is more relevant to the way people are thinking about climate change these days, especially in policy circles. But it's also useful to be able to say, look at this and compare, say, the HADCM3LC model with the HADCM3 model at a level of warming, and say, is the extra drying of the climate in the feedback model, is it due to the faster warming, or is it due to a different regional climate state? And actually, this would indicate that the regional climate state is more severe at a given level of global warming in the model with the vegetation feedbacks than without, because of the feedbacks which I've been talking about.
But the other interesting point which arises from this issue of the sea surface temperatures being one of the primary drivers of change is that another component of the Earth system comes into play, and that's aerosol pollution as well. So aerosols will affect the global radiation balance, and in fact that radiative force from aerosols tends to be negative at the net effect is negative, so there's a cooling effect from aerosols globally, so that's offset some of the warming from greenhouse gases, which is obviously well known. But it also has, because the aerosols are more short-lived in the atmosphere, they rain out after a few days, they tend to be more concentrated in certain areas rather than they being well mixed around the globe. And that means that you can have localised effects on things like Atlantic sea surface temperatures. And this is a study, again, led by Peter Cox, but he moved to Exeter University by this time, looking at the effect of the aerosol pollution scenarios on future climate change and its effect on the Amazon precipitation, and putting that in the context of the drought in the Amazon in 2005, which did seem to be linked to a high warming anomaly in the tropical Atlantic. So on the left we've got another index of the tropical Atlantic gradient, slightly different to the one which I showed in the earlier figure. This is a different study, but it is still broadly the difference between north-south Atlantic temperatures. The black line is observations. The red line is the previous simulation, which I've already shown, which did not include a scenario of a change in aerosols. It was only including changes in greenhouse gases. The green line is when you include a scenario of aerosols as well, observed aerosol patterns in the 20th century, and then IPCC projections of aerosol emissions going on in the future. So you can see that affects the Atlantic temperature gradient. On the right, that's the impacts of that on the rainfall in the Western Amazon in July and October. And again, you can see that the different scenarios do have a different impact on precipitation. When you include the aerosols, you offset, or you delay the drying of the climate for some years. So the aerosols are keeping the North Atlantic cool, basically, so you don't get this extra warming which is leading to this extra drying over the Amazon. But scenarios are suggesting that aerosol pollution will be reduced as you get more, you know, controls on pollution and so on. So that starts to not only unmask some of the warming from greenhouse gases, it also starts to take away those kind of localised cooling effects over the North Atlantic. So it turns out that the aerosol pollution is kind of holding back some of the impacts on the Amazon, which are resulting from greenhouse gas induced global warming. So that was all with the older HADCM3 model and its different variants with and without vegetation. I wanted to finish by talking about the new model HADGEM2 and the new features which are in that, which are trying to make this more realistic, bringing in things like land use change, for example. Because previously, all that I've talked about so far has just been the forest responding to climate change with no consideration of direct deforestation, for example. So these maps here are showing the projected changes, again in broadleaf tree fraction, by the end of the 21st century in different emissions scenarios
I'm hoping that most people here will be familiar with the RCP scenarios, but they're basically, RCP stands for representative concentration pathways, an assumption about how CO2 concentrations will and other greenhouse gas concentrations will change over the century. RCP 2.6 in the top left, that's the low emissions scenario designed to keep global warming below 2 degrees. 2.6 is the change in the global radiation balance, it's the rate of forcing at the end of the century in terms of watts per meter squared. RCP 8.5 is the high emissions scenario, so ongoing burning of fossil fuels and so on, leading to a rate of forcing about 8.5 watts per meter squared by the end of the century. And then RCP 4.5 and 6.0 are intermediate scenarios. So the bottom right is the high global warming scenario, the bottom left is the low global warming scenario. And again, like before, we're seeing changes in vegetation cover. The boreal forests in all scenarios are increasing in coverage, partly because the warming is promoting the growth of both needleaf and broadleaf trees. Also, the CO2 fertilisation is enhancing vegetation growth as well. But in the tropics, you see different patterns of change. But it might not be what you might immediately expect just from impacts of climate change, because the two scenarios which have the largest impact on tropical forests in terms of decreased forest cover are the high scenario here, RCP 8.5, but also the low emissions scenario in the top left as well. And the two intermediate ones have some increased forest cover in the Amazon and Central Africa. So there's obviously more going on than just a relationship with the global mean temperature. And what is actually going on there is the effect of direct land use, because the climate scenarios not only include emissions from fossil fuels but also emissions from land use, with spatially explicit scenarios of land cover change, making different assumptions about how land cover and land use will evolve in the future. Now, it's important to say that there's not really a one-to-one mapping between global emissions and a particular global land use scenario. You can get the same emissions from different scenarios of land use, but they've made certain assumptions to explore different storylines of future land use. Now, the two middle scenarios, RCP 4.5 and 6.0, included assumptions about using reforestation, for example, as carbon sinks, or land abandonment, or scenarios which included more intense agriculture, which allowed more wilderness to be preserved in wilderness, for example. RCP 8.5, part of the high emission scenario that went into that was aggressive deforestation scenario, so that was directly responsible for some of the emissions. But the low emission scenario, RCP 2.6, also included quite a lot of deforestation. So this, the numbers here are showing the fraction of land in each grid box under direct human disturbance. So the darker the orange and red, the greater the fraction of land which is directly impacted by people. In RCP 2.6, quite a lot of the tropics undergoes further deforestation, and quite a large fraction of that is due to the use of land for bioenergy. So to stay below 2 degrees throughout the 21st century, there has to be, in these models, an assumption of emissions not only peaking and declining and becoming zero, but actually going negative, negative emissions, actually sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. So bioenergy combined with carbon capture and storage. So that land use scenario has impacts on global vegetation directly through the land use, as opposed to through the climate change. So you get impacts on the tropical forests when you input it into these models, both in the high emission scenario and the low emission scenario.
So it's more complicated than simply climate change impacts affecting forests. So if we look at what that means for
South America, which is again most of the Amazon, but this is actually looking over the whole South American continent. These are time series of the model simulations of forest cover or broadleaf tree cover across the 20th century and across the 21st century. So in the 20th century, the control simulation with no climate change, no land use is in blue, so you can see fairly flat line there. The green line shows the historical simulation with land use fixed at the pre the pre-industrial state, so not pre-agricultural but pre-industrial. So you see a small increase in forest cover there. The orange and red lines in this panel are showing the decrease in forest cover with land use only and then land use plus climate change. And in both cases, it's clear that it's land use driving the decrease in forest cover in that historical simulation. Then the future simulation here picks up at the present day from the actual state. And again, we're looking at pairs of simulations with and without land use. So it's a different emissions, different climate change scenarios, different RCP scenarios, with land use fixed at the present day in one case, in the lighter, slightly lighter colours, and then land use following the IPCC scenario in the darker colours. So the bunch of three in the middle there is does this work?
So
this is the scenarios with climate change but no land use change scenarios, so present day land use, and they've all pretty much the same slight decline in forest cover due to climate change alone. But then when you look at the different land use scenarios associated with different emission scenarios, RCP 8.5 shows a decline in forest cover. RCP 4.5 shows an increase in forest cover, so agricultural area shrinks and forest is allowed to return to its natural state in that scenario. Then RCP 2.6, the very low emission scenario, again has this reduction in forest cover because, as I said, there's some of the land is turned over to bioenergy. So the greatest declines again are due to land cover change, not just climate change, although climate change does have a small impact.
And if I go back to the previous slide here, you do see that all these areas show a decline in forest cover in the northern part of Amazon and South America in all scenarios, that's the climate signal as opposed to a land use change signal. So we're not seeing this large climate change driven dieback everywhere, but we are seeing some of it in that region.
But although the climate change isn't severe enough to directly impact on the forest cover in this model, one thing that the model does not explicitly include in terms of an impact on the forest is the effect of fire, and that's clearly quite important. So just as a first go, we looked at what the climate change would mean if we translated it into a forest fire danger index. There's many of these such indices used in use at the moment. We used the MacArthur index, which is from Australia, and we happen to have that one already implemented for other reasons. So as a quick win, we just looked at what that would mean in terms of the climate change scenario across the Amazon in this study, in this scenario. And the high fire danger, that's when the fire start to become uncontrollable in terms of trying to fight them. The present day simulation, you only get these high stakes in the very east of Brazil. Under the low emission scenario, RCP 2.6, you get a slight increase in the area where there's moderate to high fire danger. This is the annual mean, by the way, rather than any particular season. But then if you look at the high emission scenario, RCP 8.5, you just see a larger area where the fire danger becomes moderate in the eastern part of the Amazon and high in the far northeast. So you're seeing a trend towards an increased risk of fire due to climate change, which does not directly impact on the vegetation in this model as yet. We've not got as far as covering the forest model to a fire model. We will do in the next version, but it is suggesting that the climate is getting warmer and drier enough to start to change the fire regime and perhaps have a further impact on the forest. So it may not be as good news as we might have thought just by looking at the basic HADGM 2 model with its sort of forest which does not die back like in the original HADCMV model. So basically you end up with this scenario where, this is a figure from the my chapter in the IPCC fifth assessment report, you get this quite a complex set of interactions between climate change driven by CO2 leading to drought, different severities of drought depending on which kind of climate model you're looking at, but then also land use change, logging, clearing,
invasion of grasses and promotion of fire. So all these things interacting basically to increase the risk of fire and feeding back on the forest. So basically the picture is not just man-made climate change versus deforestation, it's how they really will interact, particularly through fire,
which is probably the most the real concern about climate change and land use change impacts on forests and in the Amazon in the future.
So to conclude then, this notorious catastrophic Amazon dieback result from the older SCN3 model was a clear outlier. Other models didn't do it, including the more recent versions. And it seems to be related to patterns of sea surface temperature change to a large extent. And related to that, regional forces such as aerosols can play a part in impacting the regional climate change. But also the biophysical, so the land surface feedbacks and carbon cycle feedbacks can also play a role in enhancing the regional climate change once it's been kicked off by the sea surface temperature driven regional climate change. But the more recent climate projections now include land use scenarios as well, and these are now a first order influence on the forest cover in the Amazon in the new model HAM2ES. And most climate models still do project a drying climate in the Amazon, but to a less severe extent than the older one did. So the real concern will be how forest fire, land use and climate change interact with each other, and that could be the major driver of change in the future. Thank you.